free white males during the age of Jackson was paradoxically accompanied by a deterioration in conditions for those who were not free white males. Women and free blacks lost legal rights that they had previously possessed in some states, while Indians east of the Mississippi River were forcibly removed to Oklahoma. And interestingly, the last full debate in the South over slavery took place during this time period in Virginia, and it ended in defeat for those in the western part of the state who opposed slavery. Well, why this deterioration in conditions for all who were not free white males? That's an interesting question. The short answer in regard to women was the market revolution of this time that led to a new and in many ways a more limited role for women via what one historian has aptly labeled, quote, the cult of true womanhood. The belief that women's place was now totally in the home to raise the children and to create a haven for her husband, who spent each day in the competitive and heartless marketplace. For blacks and Indians, it was the creation and rise during this era of scientific racism that would claim they were genetically inferior and incapable of improvement. But why would scientific racism emerge at this time? It is almost as if, with the expansion of rights for some human beings, white males, others must be defined as inferior and even non-human to justify their exploitation by the privileged group.
Lecture 7, The Second Great Awakening, Enduring Impacts.
Some evangelical groups are very politically active today. That has surprised and worried many other Americans, for we are used to thinking of religion and politics as existing in separate realms. But that is not the case historically. And in incorrectly seeing separate realms, we may be confusing the First Amendment's ban on an established religion and legal separation of church and state with the very strong links between politics and religion that have always existed in American and indeed in world history. Some historians have argued that the 18th century religious revival known as the First Great Awakening played a major role in the coming of the American Revolution. How? It was the first major event that took place in all 13 colonies and thus linked them together for the first time. And its successful challenge to existing religious order undermined established habits of deference to constituted authority. That was a prerequisite for the revolution that would follow. In this lecture, we will be looking at the Second Great Awakening that took place during the first half of the 19th century. And we will focus on the ways in which it both reflected and affected American politics at the time. In the process, we will see that this 200-year-old religious movement continues to have a great influence on us today. Now, what was the Second Great Awakening? The early 19th century witnessed an intellectual and spiritual upheaval in the United States as well as Europe. The movement known as Romanticism, with its emphasis on emotion and intuition, replaced the previous Enlightenment emphasis on reason. Now, in elite New England intellectual circles, this would lead to the Transcendentalist movement. As verbalized by Ralph Waldo Emerson, whom one historian labeled the, quote, high priest of Transcendentalism, the Transcendentalist, quote, believes in miracles, in their perpetual openness of the human mind to the new influx of light and power. He believes in inspiration and ecstasy. Now, how, you may ask, could this lead to political action? That was best illustrated by the writings and behavior of Emerson's friend, Henry David Thoreau, who refused to pay his taxes because they supported both slavery and the war against Mexico. He was jailed for that. And according to some accounts, Emerson visited Thoreau in jail and asked, "Henry, what are you doing in there?" To which Thoreau replied, "Waldo, the question is, what are you doing out there?" Out of this would emerge Thoreau's classic essay on civil disobedience, which became and remains today a basic text for those who wish to engage in peaceful, illegal actions as acts of political protest. Now, transcendentalism was anything but a mass movement. The mass emotional movement at this time was the Second Great Awakening, a widespread evangelical religious revival that downplayed theological arguments in favor of personal, heartfelt experiences. These experiences often took place in huge camp meetings rather than in established churches. Theologically, the Second Great Awakening largely ended the old Puritan concept of predestination. So did Unitarianism and Transcendentalism, for that matter. Predestination was the belief that salvation was available only to a select few, chosen by God and known to God and only God, even before they were born. This was a Puritan belief. In its place now grew the belief that salvation was available to anyone who admitted his or her sins, accepted Jesus Christ into his or her life, and chose to lead a good Christian life. Sin thus became voluntary and alterable, and in rejecting it, one could be born again. Now, the process of being born again included public confessions of sin and intensely emotional behavior at these camp meetings, behavior that astounded those who witnessed the meetings. One of the earliest and most notable of these camp meetings took place in 1801 in Cambridge, Kentucky. But it was the area along the New Erie Canal between Albany and Buffalo, New York, which became the major route west after the canal was completed in 1825. It was along this corridor that many of these emotional revivals took place. So many that the area became known as the Burned Over District for all the fires of religious excitement that swept over it. The Second Great Awakening resulted in an explosion of religious commitment. Regular church attendance increased dramatically. By 1850, one out of three Americans was going to church. And it led to enormous growth for the Baptist and Methodist denominations in particular. Now, obviously, this Second Great Awakening democratized American religion by making salvation available to all. And interestingly, at the same time that American political life was being democratized by the Jacksonian movement that we discussed in the last lecture. That was not coincidence. There was clearly a cause and effect relationship here, though exactly how and in which direction remains unclear. Probably the two movements were mutually reinforcing as they braided and led to greater advances each for the other. The Second Great Awakening also had a much more specific and direct impact on politics. Many religious Americans at this time held a very different interpretation of the Book of Revelation than the one popular today. It included doctrines of perfectionism and immediatism that emphasized the need for saved Christians to save others and to work to improve and try to perfect the world. That was to be done as a prerequisite to and as a way to hasten the second coming of Jesus Christ. Now, some thought this would occur in their own lifetimes. A group known as the Millerites predicted the actual day, first in 1843 and then again in 1844. Needless to say, they were wrong. Many more thought in terms of a millennium that they believed was to precede the second coming, a millennium in which the world would be perfected and one they claimed had already begun with the establishment of the United States, if not with the discovery of the New World. Now, perfectionism led to some extraordinary communal experiments at this time, as some Americans sought literally to live on earth as they would in heaven. Since private property would obviously not exist in heaven. And since women were still considered property, some of the communes that were established abolished the institution of marriage as it was known, as well as all private property. Extremes ran from the Shakers, who banned sex altogether, to the Oneida community, in which every male member of the commune was married to every female member and available as a sexual partner if the commune approved. Far more lasting than these communes, however, was the birth and growth of this time of the polygamous Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, better known as the Mormons, under its leader Joseph Smith, and after his murder by an Illinois mob, his successor Brigham Young, who led his followers to present-day Utah. But many other evangelicals involved themselves deeply in the series of major reform movements that arose in the United States during this time, and with profound political consequences. In this, they were heavily influenced by famous revivalist preachers, such as Lyman Beecher and Charles Grandison Finney. These ministers not only rejected predestination and original sin in favor of free will and an emphasis on salvation being available to all here and now, they also preached that one could aid Christ's work by acting both to save others and to reform or perfect society. Now, they were not alone. Secular reformers were also involved in these reform movements and in the utopian communal experiments as well. Robert Owens' experiments in communes, for example. But the religious revival brought in a very large number of individuals and underlay much of what followed. Religious women would play a key role in these reform movements for reasons I'll explain in a few minutes. And Finney specifically appealed to women. That in turn would have rather unexpected consequences, as we will see. Well, what were these reform movements of the Second Great Awakening? One was in the field of education, where people like Horace Mann of Massachusetts emphasized the importance of state tax-supported public education to strengthen both religious and family values and to avoid permanent social classes in the United States. How? By giving individuals the tools they needed to succeed in this new economic world coming into existence, and to give them the values they needed to succeed, such as competitiveness and punctuality. This movement was highly successful, and it created the ideology of public education that we still live with today. Another was prison reform, with Lewis Dwight and others focusing on the rehabilitation of the lawbreaker rather than merely the incarceration of that individual. That is another ideology that we still live with today. For to rehabilitate the criminal, these reformers constructed new prisons, which became known as penitentiaries. That is a religious word at its root, penitent. And that is far from accidental. For these institutions, along with such innovative methods as solitary confinement, were designed to force the imprisoned criminal to confront himself and his sins and to convert him to a lawful life. Other reformers, such as Dorothea Dix, focused on care of the insane with the concept of the asylum as a place where sanity could be restored, rather than the old system of merely locking the insane up under utterly atrocious conditions. The origins of the word bedlam lie in such an institution in England. One of the biggest and most important reform movements of the time was temperance. Alcoholism had become a major problem at this time. Some historians have argued that this might have been due to the dislocation caused by early industrialization. Whatever the cause, alcohol consumption per person in 1830 was 3 times what it is today. And alcohol came to be seen as the evil destroyer of families, of religion, and of the ability of individuals to achieve their full potential. Early calls by preachers such as Lyman Beecher were for temperance in alcohol use, not abolition, with the American Temperance Society being formed in 1826. But this soon shifted to total abstinence, perhaps due to the nature of alcoholism and the addictive component of alcoholism. Revivalist techniques were used to convert alcoholics to abstinence. John Goff, a converted former alcoholic, was a major figure in this field, and his techniques are seen by many as key precursors to the 20th and 21st century Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, the anti-alcohol crusade appealed to all sections of the country and to all classes. But by the 1840s and the 1850s, its emphasis had shifted under such leaders as Neal Dow from moral suasion to state-enforced legal prohibition. In 1851, Maine prohibited the manufacture and sale of alcohol, and so-called Maine laws were soon introduced and implemented in other states. The movement was highly successful. Alcohol consumption fell dramatically by the 1840s. Now, while temperance may have been the most popular of the reform movements, the most controversial and the most consequential was abolitionism, the movement for the immediate and total abolition of slavery. Abolitionism differed from previous anti-slavery movements. It was not the first anti-slavery movement by a long shot, but earlier anti-slavery movements had emphasized gradual emancipation, and some had talked about resettling the slaves back in Africa. Abolitionism at this time, in the 1830s, emphasized slaveholding as a mortal sin, religiously a sin, and thus the need for total and immediate abolition by the slaveholder if he truly wished to be saved. The slaveholder was damned to hell unless he freed his slaves immediately. In 1831, William Lloyd Garrison, in the opening issue of The Liberator, asserted this new approach in very, very bold language. "I am aware," he wrote, "that many object to the severity of my language. But is there not a cause for severity? I will be as harsh as truth and as uncompromising as justice. On this subject, I do not wish to think or speak or write with moderation. No, no. Tell a man whose house is on fire to give a moderate alarm. Tell him to moderately rescue his wife from the hands of the ravisher. Tell the mother to gradually extricate her babe from the fire into which it has fallen. But urge me not to use moderation in a cause like the present. I am in earnest. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will not retreat a single inch. And I will be heard." Now, contrary to popular belief, most Northerners were not abolitionists. Indeed, many abolitionists were denounced and attacked in the North as fanatics and irresponsible agitators, as well as self-righteous absolutists. One of them, Elijah Lovejoy, was murdered by a mob in 1837. Garrison was almost killed by a mob in 1835. And neither the Free Soil Party of the 1840s nor the later Republican Party ever adopted abolitionism, at least not before the middle of the Civil War. Nevertheless, the abolitionists played a vital role in awakening Northerners to the evils of slavery and the need to do something about it. And key figures in the movement included numerous women. Women were also very active in the temperance movement and numerous other reform movements, and that created an uproar. It also led to the first women's rights movement in the United States. By the cult of domesticity then in vogue, women's proper role was in the private sphere, while men were to be in the public sphere. That private sphere focused on the home, where they were to be responsible for raising the children, as well as creating for their husbands a retreat from the marketplace, what one historian, Christopher Lash, called haven in a heartless world. This was in turn part of what another historian, Barbara Welter, had defined as the cult of true womanhood at this time for middle-class women. And it was based upon four interlocking pillars: domesticity, piety, submissiveness, and purity. Now, these ideas were in turn based upon a belief that men were by nature more competitive, dominant, rational, and secular than women, while women were by nature more cooperative, emotional, submissive, virtuous, and religious. At the same time, we see the rise of the family as an institution of affection dominated by love between husband and wife and between parents and children. This coincided with a declining birth rate as children lost their economic importance and parents practiced extensive birth control, including abortion, which was not considered a moral or religious issue at the time, probably because a baby was not considered to be alive until it moved in the womb or quickened, which was usually in the fifth month. Now, given the fact that women were considered to be more virtuous and religious and were responsible for the moral development of their children, it is far from accidental that they became very active in their churches. Indeed, two-thirds of all church members were female. But given the emphasis in the Second Great Awakening on reforming society, religious women ironically found themselves entering the public sphere, men's sphere, in their calls for temperance. Alcoholism affected them personally and for other reforms. Women's benevolent associations began to form to promote a host of moral reforms to control what were known as men's baser instincts. And this was to occur outside as well as inside the home. And women began to speak at public meetings for the first time to promote such reforms. Indeed, the abolitionist Grimke sisters, Sarah and Angelina, were the first native-born American women to engage in a public lecture tour. Now, this led to major controversies within the churches and within the abolitionist movement. And these spilled over into the issue of whether to engage in politics as well as moral denunciations of slavery. The abolitionist movement itself was splitting over whether to remain morally pure and thus not involve itself in politics, but simply issue these moral denunciations, versus those who said the only way you're going to accomplish anything is through politics. And politics involves compromise. To which the purists responded, how can you compromise with sin? Women became involved in this debate. And there was an uproar in the churches over whether women should be speaking out publicly. Now, the reform movements in general and the strong reactions to women's participation also led some women to question the validity of the entire idea system of domesticity and to launch a reform movement of their own for women's rights at the 1848 Seneca Falls Convention with Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, and Susan B. Anthony emerging as leaders and emphasizing the obtaining of the right to vote as the key issue. So what can we conclude from this examination? The disestablishment of state-sponsored religion in the late 18th and early 19th centuries ironically appears to have led to this extraordinary democratization and expansion of American religion in the Second Great Awakening, to the point where Americans became and remain today the most religious people in the industrialized world. The Second Great Awakening's emphasis on emotion rather than formal theology and on rejecting sin and accepting Christ, of course, continued throughout the 19th century and the 20th century in U.S. history. And it continues today with the contemporary evangelical movement. Indeed, some have argued that additional great awakenings have taken place throughout American history and that we are living through one right now. But the Second Great Awakening also had profound political repercussions, and those political repercussions also continued throughout the 19th century and the 20th century, and still continue to this day. Abolitionism, of course, had the most immediate impact in terms of its role in the coming of civil war. But not far behind it time-wise was the anti-alcohol crusade. Indeed, as previously noted, Maine prohibited the manufacture and sale of alcohol as early as 1851. Other states followed suit. And in 1919-1920, alcohol was outlawed nationally by constitutional amendment. That experiment, of course, failed. But the early emphasis on religious conversion continued with the birth and growth of Alcoholics Anonymous and its 12 steps. The ideologies of many of the other reform movements also continue to this very day, most notably in the fields of education, prison reform, treatment of the insane, and women's rights. Indeed, the modern feminist movement emerged from the civil rights movement of the 1960s, much as the Seneca Falls women's rights movement of 1848 emerged from the abolitionist movement of the 1830s and 40s. And the camp meeting emphasis on renouncing sin publicly also continues today. That fact can be illustrated in many ways. One way that one of my colleagues liked to illustrate it was to take a close look at the call heard on many campuses over the past few decades to, quote, stand up and admit you are a racist. Isn't that incredibly similar to stand up and admit you are a sinner, the cry at the evangelical camp meetings? Now, all Western religions do emphasize the need to confess sins, but they and their denominations all do so in different ways. Some do it privately with a priest. Some do it publicly as part of a congregation. And some do it individually before a public audience. Now, whether or not such an individual confession before a public audience is necessary to free one from the evil of racism is not the point here. The fact that people think it is, and that they unconsciously use 19th century religious rhetoric and forms, speaks volumes regarding the continued impact of the Second Great Awakening on our lives. Indeed, that rhetoric has consistently appeared throughout 20th century U.S. history, especially in our wars. Throughout the Cold War, we saw ourselves engaged in a life and death struggle, not so much against the Soviet Union as against what we labeled godless communism. In both world wars, we saw ourselves engaged in what we labeled crusades. In World War I, it was the Great Crusade. In World War II, Dwight Eisenhower entitled his memoirs, Crusade in Europe. A similar pattern occurred in the 19th century. As we will see in a future lecture, the populist movement of the late 19th century consistently employed fiery evangelical language of holy war. That was also true in the Civil War, as perhaps best exemplified by Julia Ward Howe's Battle Hymn of the Republic, which she wrote during the war, but which has become iconic. Let me quote to you just two of the many verses of that poem. "Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed the faithful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. In the beauty of the lilies, Christ was born across the sea with a glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free while God is marching on." The great observer of American life, Alexis de Tocqueville, was touring the United States in the midst of the Second Great Awakening. He said that the religious atmosphere of the country was the first thing that struck him. And he marveled at the number of sects and the apparently inseparable relationship of religion to American concepts of liberty. Perhaps in this regard, all our politics are, and always have been, evangelical.
Lecture 8. Did slavery really cause the Civil War?
Today it is commonly accepted that slavery was the primary cause of the Civil War. The North opposed it, the South defended it, and the result was, in William Seward's famous words, an irrepressible conflict, for the United States could not remain half slave and half free. As historian James Ford Rhodes put it in 1913, while there was a risk of referring any historic event to a single cause of the American Civil War, it may be safely asserted that there was a single cause, slavery. Yet, the North and South had disagreed over slavery since the inception of the country, and they had consistently been able to compromise their differences before 1861. Moreover, the abolition of slavery was not a stated goal during the 1850s of the new Republican Party of Abraham Lincoln. Nor was the abolition of slavery a Union war aim in 1861 or in the first half of 1862. At that time, Lincoln's war aim was merely preservation of the Union. In addition, most Southerners did not own slaves. And many Southern leaders would later claim that they were fighting not for slavery, but for states' rights. Over the last 150 years, historians have cited numerous other causes to explain why the Civil War took place. Nevertheless, slavery was the primary cause of the war, though not in the way Rhodes thought in 1913, and not in the way many Northerners thought in 1865, and not in the way most people still think today. The process of examining the other causes historians have cited in the centuries since Rhodes can teach us a great deal about the nature of historical study. The key issue of the 1850s was not slavery per se, but the extension of slavery into the Western territories. And when in 1853-1854 Congress passed the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which opened slavery into territories previously closed to slavery by the 1820 Missouri Compromise, it set off a firestorm. Now that firestorm, of course, led to the mini-Civil War in the Kansas Territory known as Bleeding Kansas. But ironically, it is questionable whether slavery could have survived in the Kansas Territory anyway, given its unsuitability for growing cotton. The Kansas-Nebraska Act also led to the collapse of the Whig Party and its replacement by the new Republican Party, a totally sectional party committed to reversal of the Kansas-Nebraska Act and the prohibition of slavery in all the territories. Lincoln was elected in 1860 without a majority of the total vote. He only achieved 39.8% of the total vote. But he had victories in every one of the populous northern states. That gave him a majority in the Electoral College, if not in the popular vote. And with his election, South Carolina and the other states of the Deep South seceded from the Union, the states of Georgia, Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas. And with the start of hostilities at Fort Sumter in April of 1861, followed by Lincoln's call for troops to suppress the rebellion, Virginia seceded, as did the other states of the Upper South, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Arkansas. Lincoln's call for troops was to suppress rebellion and preserve the Union, not abolish slavery. Indeed, before hostilities began, Lincoln had been willing to guarantee the preservation of slavery within the states where it existed, and had called only for the barring of slavery in the territories. And throughout the first year and a half of the war, that remained his stated aim. As he wrote in the summer of 1862, quote, "If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it." Only on September 22, 1862, did Lincoln announce that he would issue an Emancipation Proclamation. And he did so as a war measure and one that would not even take effect until January 1, 1863. And when it did take effect, it did not free a single slave on that date. Nor did it ever apply to the border slave states that had remained in the Union or to Confederate territory that had already been occupied by Union armies. The Emancipation Proclamation applied only to areas still in a state of insurrection and under Confederate control. And it fit in with previous moves by the Union Army and by Congress to confiscate rebel property, which of course included slaves, property that was aiding the Confederate war effort in numerous ways. Now, in light of these facts, historians in the early 20th century began to question the centrality of slavery to the coming of civil war. The first of these revisionist interpretations focused on the old conflict between state and national power that dated back to Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. Indeed, only 3 years after the war ended, Confederate Vice President Alexander H. Stephens maintained that this was the real conflict, with the South seceding and fighting to support the primacy of states' rights over the federal government. In his words, the conflict on the question of slavery, quote, "from the beginning was not a contest between the advocates or opponents of that peculiar institution, but a contest between the supporters of a strictly federative government on the one side and a thoroughly national one on the other. It was strife between the principles of federation and centralism." Now, this conflict, of course, was nothing new. As previously stated, it had existed since the days of Hamilton and Jefferson, and it went back to the very nature of the new government that had been established between 1787 and 1789. Was that new government under the Constitution a creation of the states, and therefore subordinate to them and possessing only limited powers? Or was it a union of the people, possessing strong implied powers over the states? The South had long defended the former interpretation, and the North the latter interpretation. And to this very day, many Americans, especially in the South, view the Civil War in these terms, even referring to it as the war between the states rather than the Civil War. But contrary to popular belief, the South had not always defended states' rights, and the North had not always opposed it vis-a-vis national power. New England, for example, had supported states' rights and opposed the federal government before and during the War of 1812 and during the Mexican-American War of 1846 to 1848, both of which were exceedingly unpopular in that part of the country. Far from accidentally, the Northeast did not control the federal government during those two wars. As historian Arthur Schlesinger Sr. made clear during the 1930s, states' rights had consistently been used throughout U.S. history by whichever section did not control the national government and felt oppressed by national power. States' rights was thus a device to protect specific sectional interests of different parts of the country, and in truth, a rationalization rather than a cause of the Civil War. But just what were those sectional interests that led the South to defend states' rights at this time? Slavery, of course. But in looking at those interests in broad perspective, many historians during the 1930s saw slavery itself as part of a much larger Southern economic interest, the defense of an agrarian economy against a diametrically opposed economic system of industrial and commercial capitalism in the North. These two economic systems clashed not only over slave versus free labor, but also over taxation, tariffs, railroads, monetary policies, and land policies. These issues all required federal action. And since the three-fifths slavery clause in the Constitution was the basis of Southern agrarian power within the federal government, disagreements over economic interests became a struggle between competing economic systems for control of that government. Historian Lewis Hacker put it quite succinctly in 1935 when he stated that the Civil War was, quote, a conflict between two different systems of economic production. And with the victory at the presidential polls in 1860 of the higher order, a counter-revolutionary movement was launched by the defenders of the lower order, the slave lords of the South. But economic differences between North and South had existed since colonial times and had never led to civil war before now. And in many ways, the very different Northern and Southern economies were complementary rather than competitive. Southern cotton fed Northern cotton mills, and the ensuing Northern clothing was then sent back South. Furthermore, the North had substantial agriculture as well as the South. Now, some historians answered that the two economic systems were in themselves part of what had become by the 1850s two unique cultures, a Southern agrarian society and a very different Northern society with very different political, economic, social, and intellectual values. The South, by this interpretation, was rural, deliberate, paternalistic, and hierarchical, with slavery having social as well as economic functions to maintain the planter class, which controlled and set the values for the South, and, of course, to keep the large number of blacks in a subordinate position. The North, on the other hand, did not have large numbers of blacks to deal with, or a planter class, for that matter, or old agrarian values. It had developed a bustling capitalist and urban value structure that was accepted by its numerous farmers as well as its urban workers and employers. Thus, two very different nations had come into existence by 1860. Now, this idea of an aristocratic, agrarian, cavalier Southern society versus a bustling capitalist Yankee society in the North, it makes for interesting literature and for interesting movies. But it is largely myth. The South was not settled by rural aristocrats and the North by an urban middle class. In addition, the North was as racist against blacks as the South was, and indeed had racial segregation laws before the Civil War to keep blacks in a separate and inferior status. In point of fact, the similarities between North and South far outweighed their differences. Both sections were dominated by people who considered themselves Americans, and both drew pride from their definition of the United States as a nation devoted to the principles of economic opportunity, representative government, and individual liberty. Ironically, however, many Americans in each section saw the other engaged in a conspiracy against liberty, particularly against their liberty. And a group of historians argued in the 1930s and 1940s that these perceptions were the real cause of the Civil War. despite the fact that neither Lincoln nor any other Republican figure proposed abolishing slavery where it existed, many Southerners believed that that was the hidden aim of what they labeled the, quote, black Republicans, to destroy slavery entirely and institute black rule in the South. Similarly, many Northerners believed that Southern slaveholders were engaged in a conspiracy, what they called the slave power conspiracy, to spread slavery to the North and thereby control the entire Union. Historian James G. Randall wrote in 1947 that one could not explain the coming of civil war, quote, if one omits the elements of emotional unreason and overbold leadership. If one word or phrase were selected to account for the war, he said, that word would not be slavery or economic grievance or states' rights or diverse civilizations. It would have to be such a word as fanaticism, misunderstanding, misrepresentation, or perhaps politics. Now, in reality, no such conspiracies ever existed. But many people believed that they existed. And people act on the basis of their beliefs, even if those beliefs are false. In other words, they act on the basis of their perceptions of reality rather than reality itself. Some historians have therefore argued that false perceptions led each side to believe that it was threatened by an illusionary plot and to go to war to defend its rights. But why did people believe such conspiracies existed? Another group of historians argue that the blame needs to be placed on fanatical, irresponsible agitators on both sides who fanned the flames of such conspiracy theories, as did blundering, incompetent politicians. But then the question arises as to why the founding fathers of the late 18th century and their immediate successors of the early 19th century had given way to these irresponsible rabble-rousers and incompetent political fools. Compare the presidents that this nation had from Washington through Andrew Jackson with those who followed, especially those of the 1850s, Franklin Pierce, James Buchanan, for example. Also, why would the American people believe and follow irresponsible agitators and political incompetence? Another fact to keep in mind is that all societies live by sets of beliefs that appear illusory to later generations who have the advantage of 20/20 historical hindsight. And to label such believers as fools is to use our historical hindsight to distort the realities of the past. Now, recognizing this fact, many historians over the past 3 to 4 decades have concentrated on examining the general beliefs, the ideologies that led Americans to their perceptions. And they have concluded that the basic problem lay with the American belief system itself, the one that had been largely created during the age of Andrew Jackson and the Second Great Awakening, the subjects of 2 previous lectures in this course. Americans had come to believe that there should be no barriers to their individual efforts to achieve their own destiny and perfection, and the destiny and perfection of their society, this nation of equal rights, equal opportunity, and individual liberty. The problem was that Northerners and Southerners had, by the 1850s, defined their freedom in diametrically opposed terms. The Southerner's fundamental right to his property, including slaves, and the free movement of that property, collided with the Northerner's right to compete in a free market of equals, not with slaves or slave owners. Slavery also conflicted with the Northerner's concept of the rights that all human beings possessed. As illustrated by the political slogan, free soil, free labor, free men. As the historian Avery Craven put it as early as 1950, quote, right and rights had become the symbols of all those interests and values that divided North and South. and they had an emotional force and moral power far greater than the sum total of all the material issues. Some historians, such as Arthur Schlesinger Jr., argued further that these symbols possess such power because at its root, the conflict over the extension of slavery was a moral conflict. That's what gave it such power. Other historians, such as Alan Nevins, argued that the slavery issue was inseparable from what he called the, quote, complementary problem of race adjustment. The root of the conflict was that neither side was willing to face these conjoined problems squarely. Other historians, like David Donald, saw the cause of this unwillingness to be a society that he labeled one, quote, suffering from an excess of liberty and consequently unable to deal rationally with differences. As he put it, the permanent revolution that was America had freed its citizens from the bonds of prescription and custom, but had left them leaderless. Never, he wrote in 1960, was there a field so fertile before the propagandist, the agitator, the extremist. Now, by the 1970s, another group of historians had begun to argue that a nation so devoted to individual liberty lacked, almost by definition, the strong social and institutional frameworks adequate to deal with differences short of war. And by 1860, the few frameworks that did exist and that previously had bound the nation together, from the different Protestant religious denominations to the Democratic Party, had fragmented along sectional lines. David Bryan Davis put all of this together in the 1970s and 1980s when he wrote that there had been, in the four decades before the Civil War, quote, an overleaping of boundaries of every kind and a growing belief that the American people as a whole, like the American individual, were, quote, free from the burdens of the past and free to shape their own national character. But the one problem their ingenuity could not resolve, he noted, was Negro slavery. Paradoxically, the South increasingly came to regard Negro slavery as the necessary base on which freedom must rest, he continued. From the North, a commitment to slavery's ultimate extinction was the test of freedom. Each section detected a fatal change in the other, a betrayal of the principles and mission of the Founding Fathers. Each section feared that the other had become transformed into a despotic and conspiratorial power. Well, what do we make of all this? First of all, these different interpretations of the causes of the Civil War make abundantly clear that history is a subjective discipline in which such disagreements are common. The study of these disagreements is called historiography. And historiography is essentially what we have been doing in this lecture. Secondly, specific interpretations are usually tied in some way to the era in which they were written. It's far from accidental that the generation that fought the war would come to view it in the North as a moral struggle over slavery and in the South as a more defensible support of states' rights. Similarly, it is far from accidental that the economic interpretation gained great popularity during the 1930s, the years of the Great Depression. Nor is it surprising that interpretations emphasizing fanatics and incompetent politicians should arise as people in the 1930s began to see World War I as an avoidable conflict and who were simultaneously witnessing the rise of Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini. Nor should we be surprised that all these alternative views to slavery as the cause of the war emerged in decades of intense racism in the United States. Nor should we be surprised by the reemergence of slavery as a moral issue and the question of race relations in the era of civil rights and in the years following the end of World War II and the full revelation of Nazi racial atrocities. As I noted in the first lecture, on the origins and development of religious toleration, with a rather flippant comment, which I will repeat here, Hitler gave racism a bad name. The emphasis on psychological interpretations in this same time period should not surprise us either. Indeed, David Donald's interpretation is quite similar to David Reisman's concept in the 1950s of other directedness in contemporary American society. Nor should the emphasis on ideology that developed during the many years of the Cold War, which was an ideological conflict between communist dictatorship and democratic capitalism, as well as a power conflict. It is important to realize that if one accepts this ideological approach, then all the previous interpretations retain their validity. For even if there were no conspiracies in reality, no truly irreconcilable differences in economies or cultures, no basic disagreement over the nature of the Union, and no chance of slavery establishing itself in the territories, Americans North and South believed otherwise because of their ideology, and they acted upon the basis of those beliefs. Furthermore, ideology and perceptions are themselves products of all the general factors previously cited as causes of the war: economics, culture, politics, political theory, moral values. And the common denominator linking all of these previously cited causes is slavery. It was the base of the Southern economy, Southern culture, the conspiracy theories North and South, the fanaticism, politics, moral arguments, racism, conflicting Northern and Southern definitions of rights, and ensuing ideological conflicts. It is therefore the basic cause of the war. Thus, deep down, weren't Southerners correct in seeing abolition as the eventual goal of the North, and the outlawing of slavery in the territories as merely the first stage in this long program? And did not the Southern defense of slavery as a positive good instead of the necessary evil that defined slavery in the 18th century? Didn't the defense of slavery as a positive good imply its eventual extension to the entire country? And given all this, was Abraham Lincoln being simplistic and wrong, or in actuality very perceptive and correct, when he said that the nation could not continue to exist half slave and half free? As he wrote to a Southern senator in 1860, "You think slavery is right and ought to be extended, while we think it is wrong and ought to be restricted. That, I suppose, is the rub. It is certainly the only substantial difference between us." But if Lincoln was correct, have we simply come back to the earliest interpretation and in reality wasted our time over the last 150 years in false interpretations and indeed sophistry linked to the values of specific eras and the individual agendas, the individual hidden agendas of specific historians? Not really. We are far from seeing slavery as the basic cause in the simplistic way originally proposed right after the war. Indeed, we now have a much better understanding of the causes of the war than ever before, and of the ways in which our interpretations are shaped by the values of our era. I often try to explain and illustrate this in class by asking my students to imagine that the blackboard in front of the classroom is an event, and that time is all the space in the room running from the blackboard to the back door and beyond into infinity. An individual who lived through an event, who was part of that event, I illustrate, has his face right up against the blackboard. He sees in incredible detail one small part of the event, but only that small part. As time passes, more and more of the blackboard is seen, though with less detail, a problem historians overcome through the use of primary sources from the time period. But historians don't stand dead center in the room as time passes. Most, if not all, stand on the left side of the room or on the right side of the room and higher or lower, depending on the events and values of their particular era. And that gives each of them a new and unique angle.